I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we.
Good morning and welcome to a very busy edition of EcoTalk. Lots of interesting and important topics to cover today, including the latest on the bad energy bill and a new agreement between the U.S., Australia, India, and China to limit greenhouse gases, supposedly, as an alternative to the Kyoto Protocol. We'll find out what's up with that unexpected and unlikely pact in an interview with Greenpeace. Our first half hour will be dedicated to what's new in the effort to bring about a sea change in the state of our oceans, sorry about that pun, beginning with the release of a brand new Blue Movement directory put out by the Blue Frontier Campaign. The president and founder of that campaign, David Helvarg, is joining us in our San Francisco studios to talk about that and other developments. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me here, Betsy.
This is a pretty thick directory, the Ocean and Coastal Conservation Guide. I had no idea, and I'm usually pretty aware of these environmental nonprofit organizations working to help protect our planet. This is more than 200 pages, it seems, or just about 200 pages.
Some 2,000 organizations, citizen activists, and institutions that are really dedicated to protecting, exploring, and restoring our living seas.
Who knew there were so many blue organizations, as you're calling them now? You want to put some more blue into the red, white, and blue. Tell us what you mean by that.
Simply, we talk about the frontier that was lost, you know, the wilderness areas that were abused. And few people realize in 1983, for the wrong reasons, really, because they thought there was great mineral wealth in the deep oceans, President Ronald Reagan extended U.S. control, what they call the exclusive economic zone, 200 miles out from our shorelines. It's an area six times the size of Louisiana Purchase. We now have control over more salt water than all the landmass of the United States. And when you fence off the seas, as 40% of the world's oceans now are, my sense is you need to except that you're taking greater responsibility and stewardship for what you do with them.
The oceans comprise about 70% of the Earth?
71% of the Earth's surface, about 96% of its living habitat.
That's worth looking at and protecting.
It's, you know, we're spending billions to go off with NASA to the moon and Mars. And why are we going to Mars? To see if there's water there.
Because we need another planet because we're destroying this one.
And this one is mostly about water. And, you know, unfortunately, even a lot of environmentalists, when they think of the environment, don't think of that other 71% of the planet, which is salt water. We have this terrestrial bias. We're air breathers, so we call it planet Earth. Clearly, you get out, you look from space back at this blue marble wonder. It's planet ocean.
I'm always struck by that. When they show the space shuttle pictures looking down on Earth, you go, wow, it's mostly water.
And it's the driver of climate and weather. It's the source of life, and 85% of the biodiversity of the variety of life is in the oceans. When I was a kid, I thought, you know, at camp, I'd look up at the stars and feel bad because I felt I was generations too young to go travel to alien worlds. And the first time I went snorkeling, the first time I went diving, I realized there's whole other alien worlds on our planet. You keep rediscovering them. Just a few months ago, I went diving with the Santa Barbara Channel Keepers, one of those 2,000 groups that are out there doing work. They took me out to the Channel Islands to show the first open ocean restoration of eelgrass. And well, I was down there and encountered a sarcastic fringe head. It's a mottled brown fish that's so ugly it's attractive, and it's got this
attitude.
Did you
say a sarcastic fringe head?
That's what they call it.
That sounds like someone that would call in Air America or something.
it's one of those alien species, and it was attacking my faceplate. It, you know, had this attitude. If I was 9 feet instead of 9 inches, I'd be the terror of the sea.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's wondrous. I mean, you're out there, and you see, you know, the variety of corals, of environments, like in California, the kelp forests, of big sharks, big fins, and it's wondrous. I just was diving in the Blue Hole in Belize. There were big bull sharks around, and it's kind of scary. They're the species most responsible for attacks on humans, but even at that, 7 humans were killed worldwide by sharks last year. We killed over 100 million sharks, mostly to take their fins for a kind of tasteless soup popular in Asia because it's a status thing to serve shark fin soup at a wedding shows that you have a lot of wealth. Well, it's the kind of wealth that depletes the Earth's living
like so much wealth and overabundance and overconsumption. Well, even scarier than that, those sharks, wouldn't you say what's happening to the state of our oceans is extremely worrisome in terms of, you know, we've just had so much. It's like climate change and oceans. All of a sudden, the evidence of degradation is mounting up so rapidly, it's almost overwhelming.
It's a cascading series of disasters from overfishing for the global seafood market to the nutrient poisoning of our coastal oceans from agricultural and urban runoff, the coastal sprawl we see in this country. 17 of the 20 fastest growing counties are coastal, and this is covering up the salt marshes, all the nurseries and filters of the sea that we need for restoration. And on top of that, you put climate change, where we've warmed the world's oceans 1 degree since the Industrial Revolution. It's going to be another 3 degrees in this century. We have beaches eroding worldwide. We have coral bleaching that's killing tropical reefs. We have intensified hurricanes. And you know, the best available science is coming up with the worst imaginable scenarios. Policy's not responsive. Now, I wrote this book, Blue Frontier. You'd think after I find all this, I'd be, you know, ready to walk into the sea and drown myself. Oddly, I ended up fairly optimistic, and the reason why is because of all these engaged watermen and waterwomen that I met across the country that are in this directory, groups who have the solutions. You know, they're practical solutions, and there's a sense that restoring bountiful and healthy seas also is good for coastal economies and cultures. We've got the answers. It's not a technical question. It's a question of political will. We have to take all the folks like the Surf Rider Foundation, surfers who, you know, went into the ocean for their stoke and came out with ear and gastrointestinal infections, the water keepers who started as river keepers and they followed gravity down to the estuaries and now they're bay keepers and ocean keepers. There are thousands of local regional groups who are doing great work, and what we have to do is scale that up to the national and global level. We've had two major ocean commissions, very different makeups. The Pew Ocean Commission was independent. It was made up of a scientist, environmentalist, fisherman. And then the Bush administration appointed its own ocean, U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, led by Admiral Watkins. There was another admiral. There were oil people and other industrial reps on this council. After several years, it was amazing. They came to very similar conclusions.
That should tell you something.
That they
even
were both
Bush's appointees agree.
That they took a dispassionate approach to their studies. They took it seriously.
That's what's supposed to happen, isn't it?
That's what commissions are supposed to do. And now you have these two commissions. They basically agree that we need a radical reorganization, that we need to do what they call ecosystem-based management to protect our oceans. They came up with hundreds of recommendations. They were very similar about how we do nutrient reduction, about how we control the overfishing. They offered the solutions. Unfortunately, the administration's response has been what they call an ocean action plan, what I call happy oceans. It goes with clear skies and healthy forests. It's rhetoric without commitment. The only thing of 250 recommendations from their own commission, the one they identified with is privatizing fisheries, because when you say privatizing, they get all excited. But in terms of reality, they're doing very little inside the Beltway. It's rhetoric without funding, without real support. You go outside the Beltway, you find that those reports are getting resonance, and other reports like Rand Myers, a scientist who I know who put out a report, says 90% of the large fish in the world's oceans have been wiped out. The oceans still have tremendous resiliency. They can respond to proper treatment. They can respond to restoration initiatives, which, interestingly, are happening now in California, in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island. People are responding to the recommendations. All three states have Republican governors. The difference is citizen engagement. In places like California, there's that sense of entitlement. The oceans belong to all of us. And this is the reality. It's a public trust. You don't have property issues out there because all that 3.4 million square miles of American ocean belongs to all of us.
Of course, if we start oil drilling off the coast, that's going to upset the delicate balance there and get rid of some marine sanctuaries, I hear.
And this is
even they would not be off limits.
Well, the administration, even though their own commission says this is a national treasure and that our environment, our economy, and our security depends on treating it correctly, they still view the oceans essentially as a gas station and a freeway, a place where you move ships and drill for oil.
A landfill, too, up until recently.
And the pollution we've got, you know, in the 1970s, we had the Clean Water Act, and it helped reduce point source pollution from factories, from sewage plants. And there's ways that we can reduce that agricultural runoff that creates these dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere. All that agricultural runoff, you know, if we have less chemical-dependent farming, if we use only the amounts of chemical add-ins that we need in terms of nitrogen, we can make those changes. We can reduce, you know, there's no reason we, after we grow corn in Iowa, we put 140 pounds of fertilizer per acre. That excess follows gravities down the streams into the rivers. We create a second, you know, a second crop of algae we don't need. So there are answers, and the answers are with these watermen and women who are out there who need to get better organized, you know, create a political constituency to, as I say, help put the blue back in our red, white, and
great.
Blue.
Great. We'll be right back. You're listening to Eco Talk on the Air America Radio Network. Welcome back to Eco Talk, and we are speaking with David Helvarg. He is the president and founder of the Blue Frontier Campaign. That's a group working to strengthen America's ocean constituency. And to further that goal, they've just come out with a new book, very handy guide for anyone concerned about oceans and wanting to hook up with other people working on the state of our seas. It's called The Ocean and Coastal Conservation Guide, put out by the Blue Movement. And I like that term because we always think of green organizations, but blue.
Blue is the new green.
Blue is the new green. Just like 50 is the new 30, right? Why would I mention that? Okay, so we want to talk about this really frightening development just in the last couple of weeks. You're based in Washington, D.C., but I'm sure you're aware of this big story.
I'm a Californian in exile.
Some coastal disturbances here from Vancouver all the way down the coast of California. Some dead birds showing up and signs of plankton degradation. Tell us about it and what you think is behind it.
Well, it's not even some birds. The reproduction of a range of species of seabirds has declined, along with the decline of phytoplankton and zooplankton. The traditional upwelling of cold, deep nutrient water has declined, and this follows a regime change. I've been talking to fishermen out here who are very worried that even as some of the California, you know, fishermen and fishing groups like Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations have developed an attitude of long-term conservation and working for local and sustainable seafood progress, that they're seeing radical shifts in the very nature of offshore waters. We're seeing this warming trend that started in the 1970s, and we're seeing its impacts in things like collapses of reproductive upwellings, and that has a cascading effect where you see the bird colonies in the Farallones, for instance, which have been the largest bird colonies south of Alaska, have seen dramatic decline in recent months and years. And also in the fisheries themselves, I just spoke yesterday with a herring fisherman in the bay. It says huge numbers, but very small, and small they think because they're losing the krill and the phytoplankton that are kind of the base of the system. I've seen the same situation recreated when I was in Antarctica, and the chief scientist there told me, he said, you know, when he was a graduate student, his professor said, climate change is real, but you'll never see it in your lifetime. Mm. He says, but in the last 20 years, I've seen ecosystems altered. I've seen species changing places, glacial retreat. And this is, you know, up through the 1980s, 4 out of 5 winters down there, so heavy sea ice. Now it's 1 or 2 out of 5. It's what I talk to scientists, you know, across the board, and they're very worried. The marine impacts of climate change are going to be the most dramatic simply because this is where most of the life and diversity is.
Well, this is a pretty dramatic finding. Did the, you know, data gatherers happen to just be, you know, doing their survey and found all this, or did all of a sudden people at various points along the coast, West Coast, say, oh, my gosh, something's happening here. We're getting dead birds washing up. And then I want to just hear a little bit about phytoplankton. Is that the canary of the oceans?
It's cumulative in terms of the studies. California is unique, and that has CalCOFI, which is the California current analysis that's been going on since the sardine collapse in the 40s. Unfortunately, much of what's happening in terms of oceanic decline is hard to document because we don't have a baseline. We don't even have accurate mapping and surveying of the ocean basins of the world. Right now, we've mapped about 10% of the oceans with the acuity that we've mapped 100% of the moon and Mars. So we're mapping, we're discovering new parts of the ocean and new species in the ocean in places like the Monterey submarine canyon, we're discovering even as we're destroying. We've just, in Alaska, the Fisheries Council up there just did a very strong conservation initiative to protect deep-sea corals by not allowing bottom trawling. Bottom trawling is like destroys environments that we're only beginning to understand.
Is there more plastic showing up than plankton? I've heard that used as a sign of trouble, that there's actually more plastic out there than plankton at this point.
In the Pacific Gyre, they found, in terms of weight, plastic doesn't biodegrade, and so it just breaks down into a dust, and this plastic dust by weight is greater weight than the phytoplankton in the Pacific Gyre, where all these pollutants come together. Most of the pollutant is land-based, and we can do things in our own lives and collectively to reduce that runoff. Our next book, 50 Simple Ways to Save the Seas, talks about, you know, Philippe Cousteau, who's the grandson, who's an activist. He's got a foreword where he says, it's not a question of becoming engaged. We're engaged in everyday activities. It's understanding how our individual actions impact the environment and then working collectively, what we call the, you know, in terms of marine seaweed, marine grassroots activist, coming together to form an effective political constituency, because we don't only need to know more of the biological science of the oceans, we need to know more, but we also need to build this informed and engaged political constituency. Barbara Boxer, Senator from California, has just introduced this Comprehensive Oceans Act. We need something at the level of the Clean Air or the Clean Water Act of the 1970s that can bring constituencies and people together, because we all get so much out of the ocean in terms of energy and recreation and protein. Absolutely. And just that spiritual connection. We're all connected to the sea. It's the driver of weather and climate. We get so much out of it that people are beginning to understand we have to give something back. And that's what we call this upsurge of citizen action, the Seaweed Rebellion.
We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more old paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on the sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's dig our heads
out. Welcome back to Eco.